From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk about a medical marijuana shortage in Michigan. Also, a new movement to push Congress to combat climate change.
Top scientists in the world are telling us that we have only until 2030 to dramatically overhaul our economy in order to stop the worst of climate change.
A Department of Defense official asks for a controversial scientist to review the dangers of PFAS chemicals.
He has for years been the go-to science for industry when they've wanted to show that a chemical is less dangerous.
The census is not until next year, but Detroit is working to make sure everyone is counted.
Adults, black and Hispanic males are another seriously undercounted population.
And our political commentators are a little skeptical about some of the shenanigans during the lame duck session.
All of these denials, they don't pass the smell test here.
All of that plus an artisan of Michigan for you. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. With the legalization of recreational marijuana, in addition to the already legal medical marijuana, you would think that getting cannabis would not be a problem for people who need it or people who want it. But there's a shortage. Most of that shortage is because of the state government. It's still working to establish a regulatory scheme for medical marijuana, which was legalized more than a decade ago. Joining me now is the executive director of the recently formed Michigan Cannabis Industry Association, Robin Schneider. Hi there.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on the show.
So let's talk about why it's taking the state government so long to establish the regulatory framework for medical marijuana.
Sure. We've seen difficulty with many of the applicants getting through the licensing board. The board only meets once a month, and they're denying applicants for reasons that I would say are arbitrary and capricious. And what we've noticed is our members who are applicant members who are waiting in line to go before the board, they're really, some of them have not completed their applications because they are concerned with being publicly humiliated in front of the board and don't want to lose their opportunity to get a license. So, you know, we do have concerns about the licensing process. We would like to see it sped up, especially there's a drastic need to license more growers and processors to get legal product into the system so that the patients can obtain it through the provisioning centers.
Yeah, I want to talk about that part a little bit more. But right now, I want to talk about the state government just did allow as many as 60 closed medical marijuana dispensaries to reopen while working to meet their licensing requirements. Isn't that going to solve the problem?
That's a temporary solution, and we are very grateful to Governor Whitmer and the Bureau of Marijuana Regulation for finding a way to get patients their access back quickly. But it's that rule only lasts until March 31st. So in the meantime, it's very important that we get all of these growers and processors that are waiting in line for their license to be able to obtain their license. And we also need to make sure that moving forward, that the existing growers are ramping up their supply so that there's enough product to supply the licensed facilities once the March 31st deadline is up.
I want to get back to the medical marijuana patients. If recreational marijuana is now legal, can patients get cannabis from friends as a gift?
They can, absolutely. And when I say gift, the correct term in the adult use law is without remuneration. So it can't be a trade. It can't be a barter. It really needs to be without receiving anything back in return. So if you have a friend who you want to share a little bit of your cannabis with, you can pass them, you know, a piece of medicine, but you can't get anything in return for that.
Now, you've been talking about the growing and processing. Is it strictly licensing? And you mentioned you wanted the growers to get growing. Can they cultivate when they're not yet licensed?
No, they cannot.
So what is taking so long? You can't have recreational marijuana and medical marijuana if there are no sources for marijuana.
That's correct. And that's why part of this temporary rule to get the stores restocked allowed caregivers to supply them temporarily to give those growers time for their products to come in. And, you know, cannabis can take months to grow. So, and after that, it has to be cured properly, dried out properly, and tested. So it does take time. And that's why, you know, moving forward, we need to find a better, faster way to issue these licenses.
So the concern is that medical marijuana patients aren't getting supplies, but their caregivers can grow and supply them, and any excess they can sell to dispensaries, right?
That's correct. Every patient can still use their caregiver to get their medical marijuana, but considering that we're close to 300,000 patients, they don't all have caregivers. And so for now, temporarily, the caregivers are allowed to supply the provisioning centers directly with medicine, and that is a very temporary solution to a long-term problem of supply. As of March 31st, they will no longer be allowed to take their overages, extra medicine, to the facilities. And so it's important in the meantime that we get more growers licensed as quickly as possible and that we get the existing licensed growers up and running and supplied.
So how long do you think it'll take to cut through that red tape to finally get to the point where the supply is there for the need?
I think to completely fill the supply gap, it could take 6 months to a year.
Wow. Let's talk quickly about your organization. What are the goals of the Michigan Cannabis Industry Association?
Yes, we are Michigan's Cannabis Trade Association, and we represent all license types and ancillary businesses, including insurance companies, banks, consultants, and anybody really who has a service to offer to our industry. Michigan is the second largest cannabis market in the country, and with the passage of the adult use legalization, we are in the cusp of building a major new and exciting industry. So we're seeing a lot of business activity taking place, and our members need to be able to network with each other through our association, provide each other services through our association, as well as have representation and speak with one clear voice for the good of the whole industry when it pertains to lobbying and media and public education.
Well, you're recently formed. Is the government listening?
I think they are. Within a couple hours of our first press conference, we saw new rules and regulations roll out, and we're very grateful for that. And I do think that they're listening. And I think that as our membership grows, we'll have more standing to protect the interests of our members.
Robin Schneider is the Executive Director of the Michigan Cannabis Industry Association. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's been a little while since we visited with an artisan of Michigan, so let's go to a woodshop near Ann Arbor. David Zaret builds cabinetry for kitchens, but he started out as a software engineer.
It got to the point where I just couldn't stare at a screen anymore after 20-some years of doing it. And though I still love engineering software and I'm still involved in it, day by day, I have to do a physical build rather than a virtual build.
And when he says physical, he really means it.
The best days are those when I am exhausted, sore, bleeding, and disgustingly dirty. And those days are the best.
Why?
Well, it's just, you know, the exercise of putting your hands on something natural and something tangible, which is kind of unlike what I'm used to in software, which my previous career, and going from a tangible, beautiful material into something useful and beautiful and functional in the home is what I live for. I love it.
This all started years ago when he bought a century-old two-story graystone in Chicago.
There was beautiful oak trim done by the craftsman back in the late 1800s. And there was this built-in in a nook in the first floor. In the second floor where I lived, and I renovated the entire place, but in the second floor in the 50s, there had been a fire.
He says looking at the unit downstairs and knowing what the second floor could look like, he just kept thinking, one day, I'm going to have to replicate that built-in cabinetry that's supposed to be there.
It took me the better part of a decade to get my confidence level up, to get my tooling up. I didn't have any training woodworking at all. I didn't have relatives in the trade or anything like that. It was a lot of reading, a lot of experimenting. And frankly, a lot of it is overcoming lack of self-confidence early on.
Since then, he's done 23 high-end kitchens for family and friends. He's got definite ideas about what's beautiful. First, he prefers the traditional style. He says he doesn't see anything wrong with the Euro style that's become popular, but that's just not his thing. Second, he really doesn't think you should see the appliances when they're not in use. He builds doors that open and slide back to access the oven and stove. You don't see the refrigerator. What you do see are basically floor-to-ceiling beautiful wood panels. Finally, he doesn't like to waste the hardwoods he uses. Why use more than absolutely necessary?
I do a lot of veneering, and I buy from a veneer dealer in New York State that specializes in really high-end veneers, but I try to stick to North American hardwoods. We are blessed to have some of the most fantastic trees in the world here, or close to us in Canada, and I don't see any reason to be taking down rainforests. I just don't.
He says veneer maximizes the value and the volume of a given tree. Plus, those thin slices from the same tree can be bookended so that the pattern on one door is reflected in the opposite door. Think butterfly wings. You'll have to look at the photos on the Michigan Radio website to get the idea. Zaret also buys a lot of local urban lumber. When somebody's building, sometimes trees are taken out. He says it's mortifying when those trees get cut down and then put in the chipper. So he mills it himself, or he has it milled. I asked him a question that I ask a lot of artisans, and that is, can you see flaws in your work when you're finished? Like everyone else answered, he sees things that no one else actually would, but he says he doesn't think about it that much.
I think that it's the exercise of doing the work more than the end result that drives me. And I think I've always been that way. It's, you know, what tooling do I have to make? What knives do I have to make for the next job? What jigs do I have to make to support the curved piece for the next job? That's the stuff that I really like. I think I'm more of an engineer than an artist.
He says he's still using his computer engineering skills to design the tools, program certain woodworking equipment. That engineering gene didn't disappear. It's just evolved into making cabinetry and casework that is stunning precision work.
I've not found a better combination of engineering and artistry.
David Zaret is our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Stick around, we'll find out what the Green New Deal is next. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's a new movement which is pressuring Congress to make laws to reduce the impact of climate change. Now, you remember FDR's New Deal, the huge job program during the Depression. This is called the Green New Deal. The group pushing for the Green New Deal is called the Sunrise Movement. One of the co-founders is Will Lawrence of Michigan. Welcome to Stateside, Will.
Thank you, Lester. It's great to be here.
So give us an outline. What is the Green New Deal?
So the Green New Deal is a plan to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs for people all across this country in the process. Key elements of a Green New Deal are to eliminate all greenhouse gases from our economy by 2030, to guarantee every person in this country a living wage job who wants to participate in that transition, and to do all this in a way that is restoring ownership and building wealth in communities of color, rural areas, and other disinvested communities who have been left behind in our current economy.
It all sounds great. It sounds really ambitious, but how would it actually work? How do you get Congress to move on something like that?
Well, we're not expecting to pass anything in the next 2 years. What we're making is an argument about the direction of this country and making the case that congresspeople like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the other 44 members of Congress who have backed this plan have a more compelling, more just, and more optimistic vision for the future of America than either the Republican Party or much of the Democratic establishment have on offer.
I wanted to ask you about that specifically because your group held a sit-in outside of Nancy Pelosi's office. How receptive have establishment Democrats been to real and substantive changes, laws regarding climate change?
Well, frankly, not very receptive at all, because we've seen that this crisis has intensified over the course of my entire lifetime. And some of these people have been in office my whole lifetime, and they haven't found a way to get it done. In our assessment, that's because they haven't really understood how severe of a crisis this is. And too many of them have been taking campaign contributions from the fossil fuel companies that are actually driving this crisis.
What kind of timeline are you talking about as far as, you know, of the seven demands that your group is making? Some of them are about completely converting to renewable energy, eliminating half the greenhouse gases emitted in the U.S. What kind of timeline?
Well, the critical thing is that we make a plan immediately and not leave a second to waste, because we have a window of opportunity. We know nothing is going to happen with GOP elites controlling the Senate and Trump in the White House. But the international climate scientists, the top scientists in the world, are telling us that we have only until 2030 to dramatically overhaul our economy in order to stop the worst of climate change. So we need to make a plan now and then be prepared to implement it beginning in 2021 as soon as we hope we claim the Senate and kick Donald Trump out of the Oval Office.
We're speaking to Will Lawrence of Sunrise Movement. As we said earlier, you're one of the co-founders of Sunrise Movement. How did that come about?
You know, I grew up here in Michigan in East Lansing, and then I went out of state for college. And in my college years, I became involved in the movement that was happening at the time to divest university endowments from fossil fuel companies. Again, for a long time, efforts on climate change have been really focused on reducing our individual consumption, driving less, recycling, and all of that is excellent and important. But we were saying at that time, look, these oil companies knew about climate change back in 1975, 15 years before I was even born. And rather than transitioning their business model to a more sustainable way of doing things, they actually invented climate denial by spending hundreds of millions of dollars on a misinformation campaign to cast doubt on the science about climate change. And this is why we're in the position we are now. So these companies, similar to the tobacco companies in previous decades, are bad social actors. And we cannot be doing business with them as institutions, but through investing in them and just claim like it's business as usual. So I was involved in that effort around divestment. And then over the years, we built and trained a lot of young people through that effort, won a lot of divestment campaigns, and then moved on to, you know, what we hoped would be the next bigger, more powerful thing to actually take this fight to the political system. And that ended up becoming Sunrise, which we launched in April of 2017.
There are other climate change groups. I mean, Bill McKibben's got his 350.org. Why not just lend your efforts to something that's already established? Why do you think another climate change group was necessary?
Yeah, well, we love Bill. We love 350. We've worked closely with them over the years. And we just felt that looking around the landscape, nobody had the strategy for figuring out how to navigate in this new political environment that we find ourselves in. Early 2016, we were witnessing the rise of Donald Trump, the rise of Bernie Sanders as well, these sort of outsider candidates who, though with dramatically different value systems, were in some ways similar in the fact that they are speaking to the fact that the establishment leadership of both parties in Washington, D.C. have led us into a pretty dark place and aren't responding adequately to the challenges we face. So we're seeing these dramatic shifts in the political landscape. And around that time, early 2016, looking around the other groups, we felt like nobody was quite prepared to be able to navigate in this new political environment. And we believed that we could offer something unique.
This Green New Deal that Sunrise Movement supports would require massive energy, social, and economic change. Government generally reacts to crises. Climate change is really slowly creeping up on us, and a great number of the politicians don't see a crisis. What do you think you can do to get government to tackle something as big as the Green New Deal when some of them don't even believe yet in the science that shows greenhouse gases are being released and causing the globe to warm.
Yeah, well, let's be honest that these politicians don't feel the crisis because they're old and they're rich. They're not going to be here for the worst impacts, and they're wealthy enough to isolate themselves from the impacts that are already here. For young people and working class people around the country, the crisis is already here. We've seen this in storms in the Gulf South that have ravaged communities, in the fires that are now becoming a regular feature of every fall out west. And young people live with a cloud of anxiety over our lives because of the future we see developing for ourselves. And so the task here is to make our government a government for and by the people, which is what it's supposed to be. And if that means we, you know, get our message heard by the existing representatives, that's terrific. If they don't hear the message, we know that we need to organize to defeat them through the primary and general election process.
One of the new members of Congress, in fact, the youngest member of Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who you mentioned earlier, is actually a member of your group, has been working with you for a time. You said you've got 44 members of Congress who are supporting this idea of the Green New Deal. You've got 2 years, basically, to really get Congress to turn around if you want to hit the ground running, if there's a change in presidency. Can you make the convincing arguments that will get these folks thinking the way that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez does?
I believe that we can. Change happens slow until it happens fast. And if you had told just about anybody 3 months ago that we would have 45 members of Congress backing elimination of all greenhouse gases by 2030 and a job guarantee program to guarantee every person in this country a living wage job to be part of building that transition, I mean, you would have laughed me out of the studio, right? But here we are now, and it's because we were able to organize and to make our voices heard in a savvy and smart way, and members of our generation are sharing the fear and the anger and the concern we have for our future and our political system, but also the hope we have that things can be different if we unite together. So our movement is always growing, and we've only scratched the surface of what we need to do. We're going to launch a wall-to-wall organizing plan over the next year to make sure that every single person in this country hears about the Green New Deal. And we know that when people hear about it, 80% of Americans support this plan, including 64% of registered Republicans. So we have a strong case. The people are behind this, and we just need to organize hard to make sure our politicians get the message.
Will Lawrence is a co-founder of the group Sunrise Movement, which is calling on Congress to create a Green New Deal to drastically cut the greenhouse gases causing climate change and create jobs. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester. It's been a pleasure.
As we've reported before, areas on and around a number of active and closed military bases in this state and throughout the nation are contaminated with a family of chemicals commonly called PFAS. It's connected to firefighting training using a foam containing a PFAS chemical. The Department of Defense has been monitoring the contamination and coming up with plans to help clean up that contamination. It should be noted, though, those plans have not been fully implemented, if there's been any work at all at some bases. Now, reporting by Politico finds that the Department of Defense sought to hire a scientist who was blocked from a position at the Environmental Protection Agency by lawmakers. They say the controversial findings of the scientist downplayed the risk of PFAS chemicals. Joining me now is the Politico reporter who covered that story, Andy Snyder. Welcome.
Good to be here.
So who is this scientist?
So this is a man named Michael Dorson. He is well known among industry and public health advocates. He has for years been the go-to science for industry when they've wanted to show that a chemical is less dangerous than public health advocates and academics have been concerned about.
You reported that this goes clear back to the Teflon situation several years ago. Could you explain about that?
Absolutely. So Dorson was recommended by DuPont when the state of West Virginia was trying to figure out what to do about contamination in its area. So as your listeners may know, the state of West Virginia grappled with PFAS issues before many other states did. There was a DuPont facility in Parkersburg, West Virginia, that had major contamination of PFOA there. And it was becoming a concern. The state said, gosh, we need to come up with some sort of idea for what the drinking water limit ought to be. And they decided to convene a panel. And DuPont recommended that Michael Dorson be the one to convene the panel. That's something that his outfit called TARA, the Toxicology Excellence for Risk Assessment, the name of his group. His group often convenes these panels that are described as being independent, although he is often the chairman of these panels, and public health advocates argue that they are not so independent. But they often convene these types of panels, and so the state of West Virginia turned to Dorson's group to convene a panel, and what they ended up recommending was a limit of 150 parts per billion at the time. This was in the early 2000s. And at the same time, DuPont's internal limit was one part per billion. So the limit that was recommended for the state of West Virginia was 150 times higher than the company's own internal limit for exposure for its workers. And so that was one of the instances of Dorson's past work that was of great concern when the Trump administration nominated him to lead EPA's Chemical Safety Office.
Now, of course, the limits are, the guidelines by the EPA are something like 70 parts per trillion.
Yes, an order of magnitude smaller.
So who at the Department of Defense proposed to have this guy work on the PFAS issue for the DOD?
Yeah, so this is a little bit complicated. So as you all in Michigan are probably aware, a number of states are moving forward trying to figure out what to do about these chemicals as the federal government has been slow to act. And so the state of Kansas has military bases there and is in the early process of trying to figure out, you know, do we need to do something about these? There's, you know, EPA monitoring data from a few years ago that shows that there were some contaminations, some drinking water supplies that were impacted by PFOA and PFOS there. And so the state is saying, you know, do we need to be doing greater monitoring? If so, how do we go about this? Which chemicals do we need to be looking for? So they're in the very early stages, and they decided to convene an advisory group of, there's an environmentalist on it, there's an industry representative on it, but there's a lot of federal folks on it, including a couple of representatives of the Defense Department, given, of course, that one of the major sources of contamination is the Defense Department. And so under sort of the auspices of this group, one of the regional Defense Department representatives went to the head of the Kansas Water Bureau, who's leading this group, and said, ask the state to request a review of the chemicals. And so it's a little bit complicated, but the email that I was able to obtain under Kansas's open records law shows that the Defense Department had already cited that they wanted to hire Michael Dorson to do a review of these chemicals and was asking the state of Kansas to basically ask the Defense Department to do it, to say, you know, so that it would be the state of Kansas requesting this review as opposed to the Defense Department sort of deciding to do it on their own.
So this sets up a scenario that lawmakers have been worried about. Are they worried the Department of Defense is merely thinking about using old corporate approaches to try to cast doubt on existing science by using some outlier?
Absolutely, absolutely. There is great concern. So when I got a hold of this email, I asked Senator Tom Carper of Delaware. He is the top Democrat on the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, which is the committee that considered Michael Dorson's nomination when he was nominated for EPA. I asked him what he thought of this. And he said he was shocked. He said that it was, let's see if I can get the quote for you. It's as absurd as it is deeply troubling that despite his dangerous record on chemical safety, the Defense Department could be seeking to hire Michael Dorson for this drinking water project. So he was shocked and not happy about it.
I don't want to read too much into this, but here in Michigan, people living near the contaminated bases are wondering why the Department of Defense is not doing more, working more quickly to clean up the contamination. What's this latest revelation say about the DOD's cleanup efforts at its bases?
Yeah, so this latest revelation suggests that the Defense Department is not accepting the science that supports stringent cleanup requirements.
But the science comes from the federal government. I mean, we've got the ATSDR and the EPA both giving amounts, you know, that are not too far apart, 70 parts per trillion, 35 parts per trillion, and they're talking about something completely different?
Yeah, so this is a long time sort of industry approach has been to question the science and to say that we need further review. Critics argue that it is a delay tactic. So this is not something that is new. In fact, we've seen the Defense Department do this quite successfully with other contaminants. There's perchlorate, which was an ingredient in rocket fuel that had contaminated a number of military bases, particularly in the Southwest. That back in the early 90s, there was concern and a push for a federal drinking water standard. Today, in 2019, more than 20 years later, that standard has not been set despite court orders. And in fact, the deadline for doing so has been pushed back even further amid the shutdown. So the Defense Department has, in fact, been quite successful at pushing off these types of drinking water requirements.
Annie Snyder reports for Politico. Nice reporting. Thanks.
Thank you.
And by the way, as far as we know, the Department of Defense has not hired Michael Dorson at this point. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In the wake of the lame duck session, there have been a couple of developments that have raised some eyebrows. Former legislators moving directly from the Capitol to lobbying firms, a $10 million sweetheart deal for a former chair of the Republican Party, and no one seems to know who put it in at the last minute. Joining us are our Friday political commentators via Skype, Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader, and Vicky Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. The National Conference of State Legislatures reports among the states that provide for cooling off periods for former legislators before they become lobbyists, 10 states set the waiting period at 2 years. 26 states require a one-year gap between legislating and lobbying, and two more provide limits up to 12 months. Now, Michigan only prohibits legislators from lobbying for the remainder of the term that they would have served if they'd not vacated the office. That means a former legislator could be lobbying the members of a committee he or she chaired as recently as last month. Ken Sikkema, should there be a waiting period?
I'm not a big fan of these waiting periods. It's not a reform I would put at the top of my list. I think there are other things that are a lot more important. Part of the reason that I'm not really a fan of it is that I think there's kind of a misconception of who really is a lobbyist and who isn't. I mean, you have to register as a lobbyist, even though you might work for your local school district, a local hospital, a chamber of commerce, and it's just part of your job because you meet with legislators and therefore you have to register. So frankly, I think it's more of a perceived problem than a real problem.
And I see that because I know people get really upset about this and they get really upset about lobbyists buying legislators free lunches, which I think is the least of our problems. Vicky, does it really matter whether you wait a year or two before a former legislator becomes a lobbyist?
I think it can. And that's why I was happy to sponsor and then co-sponsor several bills that would require a two-year waiting period. First, let me say there's nothing wrong with lobbyists. Lobbyists provide needed information for legislators. Of course, it's one-sided, but that information is still good information, and you need to know that side of the story if you're going to cast an educated vote for your citizens. On the other hand, sometimes some of the bills that come up, especially in lame duck or late in a legislator's term before term limits hit, can be seen as shopping for a lobbying position. And some of these bills are very one-sided and are designed to help a legislator secure a lobbyist position with a company that lobbies for that particular bill and what's contained in that bill. And that's why I think that a waiting period is important, to separate the legislator from looking for a job and then joining the lobby corps.
Ken, what do you think of Vicky's points?
Well, another thing to think about is that, you know, 90% of Lansing lobbyists are not former legislators. In fact, it's probably even 95%. They're former staff. And they're particularly influential in an era of term limits. And, that's why I think sort of looking at legislators, focus on legislators per se, is sort of missing the target, if there is a target. And like I said, I just think it's an exaggerated problem.
Well, just remember, it's not the staff that votes and casts the votes in the legislature. It's the legislator that does.
No, Vicki's right. I mean, they're the ultimate decision maker. But particularly in the era of term limits, I think the staff has become far more influential than in the past. It's just, I think there are other reforms that are at the top of my list. This isn't one of them.
Yeah, staff has the institutional knowledge, especially with term limits. Let's turn to another topic. Bridge Magazine reporter Mike Wilkinson reported that on the last day of the lame duck session, the Republican-dominated legislature approved a $10 million grant to bring water and sewer lines to land owned by a development company headed up by the former chair of the Michigan Republican Party, Bobby Shostak. Ken, this was perfectly legal, but the optics are not great. What do you make of this revelation?
Oh, I think it's a terrible situation. This is a reform I do put at the top of my list. These special projects, they call them enhancement grants, this in the lame duck session, that get kind of put into a appropriation supplemental bill without any prior review is just flat out wrong. And, you know, 20 years ago, they were actually prohibited under the joint rules of the House and the Senate for a brief period of time because of how egregiously wrong they were. And there's a simple fix. You just put in the joint rules that these special projects cannot all of a sudden appear without having first been approved by one of the houses, either the House or the Senate. So there's been some public exposure. This is a real problem.
Vicki, how often do we see these kinds of sweetheart deals?
All the time, especially in lame duck. And that's a strong argument for getting rid of lame duck sessions. So after the election in November, there should be no more legislative sessions because these bills go back and forth very quickly without any due process, any hearings. And in the late hours of the last few days of session this year, we passed more than half the bills for 2018 were passed in the lame duck session. And the citizens have, the legislators especially, have no time to read these bills, especially when they're rewritten and changed and substituted in and out, and all of these deals are going on. It's really hard to legislate properly and to know what you're voting on. And a lot of these things sneak through. I want to point out $500,000 of this is going to fix roads in Mackinac Island where there are no cars. So when we have roads crumbling in across the state of Michigan, why isn't some of this money going to those things? And then you get into one of the reforms that Ken and I probably want to see is, why don't we talk about open meetings and open records? And here, there's no way to trace who put what in these bills because there are no requirements for the Open Meetings Act to apply to the legislature.
Right. You're getting to my next point. The legislator where the Shostak development is taking place did not know about this grant until the wee hours of the morning. The former chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee does not know who requested the grant. The legislator who reportedly lobbied for the grant earlier didn't know how it got into supplemental budget. No one wants to own this. Is this the kind of thing that legislative leaders and the Snyder administration could just slip in without anybody's knowledge, Ken?
Well, this all of these denials, they don't pass the smell test here. Line items and appropriation bills, even in lame duck, even at the end, there's at least four people who know about every single line item. That's the majority leader, the speaker, and the two appropriation chairs. I'm not buying an argument that these people didn't know what that was all about.
Vicki?
I'm not either, especially since there was a lot of horse trading going on. This is when you say to somebody, the governor really wanted some cleanup funding. He didn't get all that he wanted, but he did get some. And in exchange for some of the cleanup funding, it's been reported by Bridge Magazine that possibly he traded votes for the cleanup for some of these pork projects. So clearly people knew what was going on.
But pork is good if you're the receiver of pork in your district. I mean, some of those projects actually deserve to be done. Some are, pork barrel projects.
But one of the projects that was proposed was by Senator Coleman Young, which was $500,000 to clean up the drinking water in Detroit's public schools. That seems to me to be the kind of projects that we should be funding with this supplemental, not $500,000 going to fix roads on Mackinac Island where there are no cars. So while some of these projects are good and needed, the way that the process works is tainted, and that's part of the problem.
Ken, last thoughts.
Well, I think there's a big difference, Lester, between a project that benefits a local community like clean water or something like that versus a project that is designed to benefit a private developer solely. That's a big difference.
Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader of the State Senate. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
The census, as required by the U.S. Constitution, is meant to use that count of the people to determine representation in Congress. But it determines a lot more than that these days. As we heard on Stateside yesterday, the questions and controversy surrounding the 2020 census have experts worried about the count's accuracy. The census doesn't actually start until March of next year, but Detroit is already working on a shadow census. Vicki Kovari was appointed by Mayor Mike Duggan to lead that effort, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester.
So you've got a year before the first mailers are sent out by the federal government. Why do you need to start preparing now?
Well, the census is critically important to Detroit and Michigan, not only in terms of the kinds of money that comes in from the federal government based on census numbers, but because in the beginning of Mayor Duggan's term, he talked about his legacy being judged on the basis of whether our population was growing or not. And so we have a real sense of urgency and importance about making sure that everyone in the city of Detroit is counted. And based on what happened in 2010, when our response rate went down by 6%, and we got a fairly late start then, we really wanted to make this different and really increase our response rate this census as opposed to the one 10 years ago.
The release from the city of Detroit mentioned the hardest to count. Who mm-hmm. are these people who are the hardest to count and why?
Well, there's two ways to look at hardest to count. One is in terms of geography. So the census has given a score to every single census tract in the country based on a bunch of data that they've collected since 2010. And we've taken those scores. It's a number that predicts how many people will not respond in a given census tract. So we've looked at those numbers, and we've looked at the response rates from 2010, and we can really identify now which areas of the city, especially those with high populations, that have the greatest likelihood of a large non-response group. We're going to map all that out. This is going to be a very much a data-driven operation. But the other way to look at it is hardest to count populations. So beyond geography, the Census Bureau knows, based on years of research, that children under five are really undercounted, especially in urban areas. Foreign language speakers are undercounted. Adults, Black and Hispanic males, are another seriously undercounted population. And so we've also looked at, in the city, areas where there's concentrations of those. Millennials and young people are another undercounted population. So we're mapping all those areas where there's concentrations of those populations.
So how do you go about finding those folks and making sure that they respond to the census?
Well, we're going to have our own really robust outreach operation. We're going to rely heavily on the city's Department of Neighborhoods, who has a master list of hundreds of organizations in each of these areas and has been working with leaders in these areas for 4 or 5 years now. So we're going to rely a lot on our leadership on the ground in these neighborhoods to help us identify not only households that might be undercounted, but group quarters, which is a really difficult thing for the census to undercount, you know, adult foster care homes or nursing homes, those kinds of things. So we're going to really have a big operation. We just formed our Detroit Complete Count Committee, which is going to help us with a bunch of stakeholders, not only among these kinds of populations, but also people in business, people in universities, et cetera. So we're going to rely on them and their expertise and their networks to really help us reach into every single census tract in the city. And we're doing a big media campaign, you know, with huge online presence as well as radio, billboards, those kinds of things.
The Trump administration wants to include a question about citizenship on census forms. For now, that's been blocked by a court, but the Justice Department is appealing. How would that affect the attempt to get a proper count of people in Detroit?
Well, I think anything that makes people more fearful than they already are is bad for the census. And a citizenship question falls into that category. People have a hard time sharing information with the federal government, period. And then with a citizenship question, it makes people more fearful about how the information is going to use. Even though the census is by federal law bound not to share information collected with anybody or any federal department, they're not allowed to even make it public for 72 years. So even though there's those protections, there's still that fear out there. We think that the judge's opinion was really meticulous and have a lot of hope that it'll withstand a Supreme Court challenge.
So what is at stake if the census undercounts Detroit?
What's at stake are several things. Number one, there's estimates that Detroit itself loses about $1,400 to $1,500 per person for everyone that's not counted. If you multiply that over 10 years, we're talking about several hundred million dollars. And this is in money that comes to the state and the city through Medicaid. This is Head Start money. This is money for roads. So census numbers have a huge impact on the quality of life here and across the state. So that's one thing. The other thing is we really want to make sure that people know that they matter and that everyone, regardless of the size of their family, regardless of where they live, regardless of their race, that everyone matters in the city and it matters that they're counted. And we want to see the population grow. I think just even psychologically, it has a big impact on people to know that their neighborhood is actually gaining in population. It has a big impact on future investments in the city. So for all those reasons, this count is critically important.
It is not unusual for major U.S. cities to prepare for the census, but I get the distinct feeling that there's more urgency this time. Is that right? And if so, why?
Yes, I think there is. I think a couple of reasons. This is going to be the first online census ever. And I think a lot of urban areas, especially like Detroit, where there's a big chunk of the population that isn't connected to the internet, there's a lot of worry that they'll somehow fall through the cracks. You will be able to request a paper form, but the first thing the census is going to send out is a postcard, which is going to try to encourage people to fill the form out online. So we're all worried about how people are going to respond to that. And I think that gives us all a sense of urgency. I think the questions around the citizenship question is also a reason why a lot of larger cities across the country and other areas who have significant immigrant populations are worried and have a sense of urgency about the census. And, you know, just being able to in this kind of climate, when there is a lot of mistrust around government, that the whole political climate has been so toxic, I think that's just another layer that causes concern among a lot of us.
Vicky Govari is the director of the Detroit 2020 Census Project. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Matt. It's my pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Mike Blank. Hey, where's Rusty? Is he avoiding me or ignoring me? Never mind, I think I know. Contributors today are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Joey Horan. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening today. Have a great one, wonderful weekend, or a great one too.